Welcome to another episode of Jamaican Gangster. On today's episode, we are featuring Ja T, the fallen prince of Tivoli Gardens. If you are not following us, we would be honored if you would consider doing so. It costs you nothing to hit that button, so that you will be notified every time we release a new episode. Now, let's get into it. The shot comes without a warning. No argument. No standoff. Just a motorcycle moving along Maxfield Avenue on a February morning in 1992. And then the kind of silence that settles over a street when something irreversible has just happened. The man on that motorcycle was Mark Anthony Koch. The people of West Kingston called him Ja T. His father was Lester Lloyd Koch, the man the garrison called Jim Brown. The founding don of Tivoli Gardens, the man who built the shower posse from a political instrument into something that operated far beyond any politician's ability to control. Jim Brown was the elder statesman. He was the one who sat with the men in good suits and understood what each favor cost. But Ja T was the one in the street. Ja T was the one who held the weight of West Kingston every single day while his father handled the bigger board. In that February morning, somebody decided that the best way to reach Jim Brown was through his son. That decision would unravel everything. Tivoli Gardens in the late 1980s was not just a neighborhood. It was a fortress with a name. A government housing scheme turned into one of the most tightly controlled garrison communities in Jamaica. It sat in the heart of West Kingston, like a state within the state. The Jamaica Labor Party had deep roots there. And Jim Brown was the bridge between the political machine and the street. Residents got jobs, got protection, got mediation when disputes arose. In return, they voted the right way, stayed quiet about the wrong things, and understood that the authority of the Don was absolute. Jim Brown had built that arrangement over years. He had learned how power worked in Jamaica, the way garrison loyalty flowed upward through the political structure while guns and favors flowed back down. By the time the late 1980s arrived, he was not merely a don. He was a figure so embedded in the architecture of West Kingston that removing him would require something almost surgical. And in the years when Jim Brown was managing alliances and navigating his growing legal exposure from American federal charges, Ja T was the one keeping the machinery running on the ground. There was something people noticed about Ja T. He did not announce himself. He did not need to. In Tivoli and the surrounding communities, his presence was a fact of life, the same way the zinc fences were a fact of life, the same way the sound of a loudspeaker carrying a dance hall set through the night air was a fact of life. He moved through West Kingston as someone who understood every lane, every corner, every face, and everyone in that world understood what it meant when Ja T paid attention to you. Some people said he was his father's enforcer. Some said he was more than that. Some said he was the one his father trusted with the things that could not be written down or spoken in the presence of certain company. But the fuller truth was that Ja T was the bridge between Jim Brown's name and the daily reality of life in the garrison. And by early 1992, something was already wrong. Jim Brown was in custody. American authorities had been pressing for his extradition for years. And by this period, his position had shifted from untouchable community patriarch to a man whose legal situation was becoming difficult to manage. The shower posse's international reach, the American drug trafficking indictments, the DEA's sustained focus on the network he had helped build, all of it was pressing down on the family. Inside Tivoli, the people who were loyal said nothing publicly, but the silence had changed quality. It was no longer the silence of a community that felt safe. It was the silence of a community waiting. Word had been moving through the streets before that February morning. The kind of word that travels in whispers between people who know the shape of what is coming before anyone can say it plainly. Whether the threat to Ja T was known, expected, or simply feared is something that was never fully established. What is known is that on that morning, he was on his motorcycle moving along Maxfield Avenue, a road that ran through territory that was not solidly his, and the men waiting for him were prepared. He was shot multiple times. He did not die immediately. The Kochs bury two men in the same fortnight, one in the street, one in a cell. That line would come to mean something in West Kingston. But in the hours after the shooting, the story was only half written. Ja Tae was alive. Barely. And he was taken to the Kingston Public Hospital. What happened at that hospital became something between documented event and community mythology. Word spread fast that the system was letting him die on purpose. The People's National Party was in government, and the belief in Tavali and its allied communities was that a JLP Don's son was not going to receive the same care in a government hospital that anyone else would receive. Whether that belief was accurate is something no official investigation ever settled. What is confirmed is that the atmosphere at the Kingston Public Hospital that night was not calm. Reports documented that affiliates and supporters tied to the shower posse arrived at the hospital in force. The grief was real. The fury was real. The sense that the system had always been the enemy, and that the moment of crisis had made that enmity visible, was real. And it moved through the crowd the way such feelings move when a community believes it is watching its own be sacrificed. Some said the men who arrived were there to make sure Ja Tae received treatment. Some said their presence made treatment harder to deliver. What is certain is that the Kingston Public Hospital that night was a place where a private war between two worlds had suddenly become impossible to contain inside the geography of a garrison. The institutions of the Jamaican state and the institutions of the garrison had collided in a corridor under fluorescent lights, and neither side had a clean way through it. Ja Tae died. He was young. He was the heir to the most powerful garrison in West Kingston. He was the son of the man who had built an underworld structure that stretched from the lanes of Tivoli Gardens to the streets of Brooklyn and the Bronx and Florida. And he was gone. Inside the General Penitentiary in Kingston, Jim Brown received the news. Here is where the mystery thread that began before the shooting becomes something heavier. Jim Brown was already a man caught between legal worlds. The American extradition case was pressing. His freedom was gone. His son was now gone. What happened inside him in the days after Ja Tae's death is something that no one has ever reported cleanly, because the men who knew Jim Brown well enough to describe his internal state were the same men who kept silence as a professional discipline. What is confirmed is that in the days following Ja Tae's death, Jim Brown's situation changed. The Kochs bury two men in the same fortnight, one in the street, one in a cell. But first, there was a funeral. The funeral of Ja Tae was not a quiet affair. It was not the kind of burial that a family arranges quickly and privately to avoid attention. It was the opposite. Thousands of people came. The streets of West Kingston filled with mourners who understood that this was not merely the burial of a young man, but a statement, a display of force measured in grief, a message delivered to anyone watching that the Koch family and their world were still standing. Shops closed. The lanes emptied of ordinary life and filled instead with the slow, deliberate movement of a community declaring itself. And the politicians came. Edward Sega, the former prime minister, the architect of West Kingston's political geography, the man whose connection to Tivoli Gardens and its machinery had been the subject of commentary and documentation for decades, was among those who attended. His presence was not a small thing. In Jamaica, a politician's attendance at a garrison funeral was a statement made without words, a confirmation of alignment, a signal that the relationship between the political structure and the garrison structure had not dissolved simply because a young man lay in a casket. The Jamaica Gleaner documented the attendance and the scale. The message was clear. The Kochs were not finished. The community was not finished. And the people in those lanes expected the world outside to understand that. But the world outside was about to deliver another blow. On February 22, 1992, roughly 14 days after Ja Tae was shot on Maxfield Avenue, Lester Lloyd Koch, Jim Brown, the patriarch of Tivoli Gardens, and the founding force behind the shower posse, died in his cell at the General Penitentiary. The official account was fire. His cell burned, and he burned with it. Jamaica was stunned. The timing was grotesque. A father had just buried his son, or learned that his son was gone, while sitting in a prison cell with no ability to stand at the graveside, and now the father was dead, in a fire, in a cell. under circumstances that no official inquiry ever explained to the satisfaction of the people who knew him. Some said Jim Brown had lost the will to live the moment Jati died. Some said he was silenced before the American extradition could be completed, before he could stand in a federal courtroom and say things about the connections between the garrison world and the Jamaican political establishment that certain powerful people could not afford to hear, said under oath. Some said the fire was an accident in an overcrowded institution that could not guarantee basic safety for its prisoners. The official position left the question open, in ways that official positions sometimes do, when the full truth is inconvenient for too many parties at once. What is known is that the circumstances were never fully resolved. What is known is that the question of whether Jim Brown's death was accident, despair, or something arranged remains one of the unresolved seams in the history of Jamaican garrison power. And what is known is that the silence around that question was not accidental. It was the silence of people who understood that asking certain questions too loudly had historically produced consequences. Within days, West Kingston lost its dawn and its air in the same fortnight. The consequence escalation that followed moved exactly as these things move in a garrison world. First, it was individual. Jati was gone. Then it was communal. Tivoli was shaken, uncertain, the kind of uncertainty that in a garrison community turns dangerous because the entire social architecture depends on the clarity of who holds authority. Then it was political. The deaths exposed the depth of the entanglement between the Koch family and the JLP structure in ways that the funeral had made visible and that the prison fire now made impossible to quietly set aside. Then it was structural. The shower posse, without Jim Brown, was a machine without its original engineer. And without Jatet, there was no clear internal succession. Except that there was. There was a younger son, Christopher Koch, who would come to be known to the world as Dudas, was not yet the commanding figure he would eventually become. He was known in the garrison, known in the community, but the speed and weight of his rise were inseparable from what had just happened. Two Kochs were dead. The garrison needed an anchor. The community needed to believe that the structure that had governed its life for years had not simply collapsed. And the people around the Koch family, the men who had served Jim Brown, the women and children who depended on the garrison's version of order, needed to believe that the prince's younger brother could hold what the prince had died holding. Dudas would eventually hold it, and then some. He would build a dominion over Tivoli that his father and brother could not have imagined in their final days. He would become the subject of an American extradition case that triggered a constitutional crisis in Jamaica, a military incursion, and a death toll that still carries political weight in this country. He would become the most documented Jamaican don in American federal court history. But none of that happens without February 1992. None of that happens without a motorcycle on Maxfield Avenue, a hospital under siege, a funeral attended by a former prime minister, and a fire inside a prison cell that no one ever fully explained. The Kochs bury two men in the same fortnight, one in the street, one in a cell, and out of that double grief came the third Koch, the one the world would spend the next two decades trying to stop. Jatet never got to become the don he was built to be. He was the prince who fell before he could be crowned, the man whose death started something he could never have chosen and never could have stopped. In West Kingston, his name is still spoken, not always loudly, but in the lanes where his father built a world and where his brother eventually inherited it, the memory of Jatet is the memory of the moment when everything changed, when the shower posse's empire cracked at its foundation, and when the gap that opened in that crack was wide enough for a new kind of power to grow. That was the story of Jati, the fallen prince of Tivoli Gardens. If this episode moved you, if it taught you something, if it kept you up, share it, follow us if you have not already, and stay close, because on the next episode of Jamaican Gangster, we are going somewhere you are not ready for.